All right, this is tape two, side one, Schubert interview, July 17th, 1992. I'm curious whether you have any sense of why this particular slice of time was the heyday. I mean, it seems to almost kind of fall along political administrations. I mean, is that part of the explanation that one might give for the vitality of the organization at this particular time? Just the receptivity of government to the types of things that you were proposing to do.
I certainly think that that has had a major bearing. We were growing, we were healthy, the work was good, the work had built a national reputation. More important, our people had built a national reputation. They were regarded as what they were, honest, objective assayers of policy decisions, and they were called upon regularly to do that. Being in a growth mode always helps this kind of thing. It helps morale, it helps spirit, it helps one to be more daring than one would be otherwise. And the very fact that, I never even had to consult Rice, who was then president, before I went, or I never felt I had to. And in the event, I told Don about it after it was all over, but I didn't tell him in advance that I was going to go to HUD and quit. He ran things so that was my business. And pretty much the whole domestic operation was my business. And his interest, his primary interest, was in national security affairs, and that was pretty much our division of labor. So that our understanding was that I would consult him when there was a need that either he saw or I saw. And that became, as we grew and got more enthusiastic and got more and more involved in different things, that relationship those consultations just grew rarer and rarer until I would literally have to sort of force myself upon him to give him sort of status reports as to where we were and where we were going and that sort of thing. Now, even though he was a person whose main interests were in the military area, he certainly had broader interests in that, and he was certainly an enthusiastic supporter of Iran's domestic work, so that was a real asset to have. And Jim Thompson, I believe, is also an enthusiastic supporter of Iran's domestic work, although he too is primarily grounded in national security affairs. And my guess is that he sees, given the current environment, an even more important role for the domestic programs at Iran than they've had in the past. Financial uncertainties facing us on the defense side are, I think, immeasurable in this particular time period. And Jim is spending a lot of his time and his effort and his energy in trying to assure increases in the domestic work and in trying to assure growth of the endowment fund so that should we have problems, of which there have been none yet, that we'll be in a condition to meet them and be capable of meeting them. So, and that period went on, I would say, for some years. It was not just this 1974 or whatever. I mean, we started. You have to remember that these social experiments were long term by nature, 4, 5, 6, 8 years.
Right.
And with field periods of 4 to 5 years. And that built up a certain continuity, that built up a certain support structure, it built up a certain morale. It led to the development of individuals like Joe Newhouse, for example, who became one of maybe the three leading health economists in the United States. And he did that at RAND. Subsequently, he left RAND and went to Harvard, but he was told, and I still see him, and we're good friends, he was told, not just by me, but by Don Selden, who was a physician well acquainted with the health field and completely acquainted with academic research, that Joe would never again be able to do the kind of work he did at Rand if he went to Harvard, or any other university for that matter. And in fact, Joe was made an offer once and he rejected it. But then ultimately he was made an offer that he couldn't refuse, a large psychological part of which was consisted of two components. Come home to mother, Joe was a Harvard graduate, and two, we're not going to ever make this offer again, so this is your last opportunity, and you're not too much under 50, so you better give it some serious thought. And that's what did it. Notably, however, he still works on a continuing basis with Rand, and the work he does for Rand is inherently different from the work that he does at Harvard. I think he would agree with that. And even though he has free rein there, I think he reports only to, I think he even has an agreement that he reports directly to the Lord. Doesn't even have to report to the Harvard administration. They made such an effort to get him. So I guess he used to report to Bach, at least on the organization chart, he reported directly to Bach.
All right.
So this period of excitement and growth and so on went on, I would say, it increased steadily until the advent of the Reagan administration. And that's when the government went into a mode of national security is everything. We're not going to spend any money on research of a domestic nature. Domestic research budgets either became infinitesimal or disappeared entirely. Major cuts were made in our programs. And all that, you know, gets to you after a while. Got to our morale. We also found that with the advent of the Reagan administration, and I don't think there's anything inherently political about this because we've had people join every administration, Democratic or Republican, since I've been at Rand in senior post. But we found, as bad as things may have been under the Democrats from an intellectual point of view, they were infinitely worse under the Republicans. We couldn't find a cadre of people to talk with who understood us, who knew what we were up to, who could perceive the value or potential value of research in their area. Things became intensively political, and in some cases, like those in which we encountered in New York, there was an absolutely hostile, adverse reaction to having data laid out or having facts exposed when decisions were going to be made on political grounds in any case. And as one fellow I got to know pretty well, the head of the Civil Division in the Justice Department said to me one day, he said, I know what you're recommending, that you're recommending a commission on this subject and so on and so forth. But I'm telling you, we don't want any commission, because we know what we want to do. And we comes right from the president. And we don't want to clutter up the landscape with a lot of kook heads disagreeing and causing trouble with things that we've already decided. And we had a big argument over that. It was dubious to me that I really should have been involved anyway, so I sort of ungracefully, ungainfully left the grounds of combat. In a way, it's too bad I did, because the problem is still with us today. This was a problem concerning certain litigation that was ongoing, and it's still ongoing. And in my opinion, is being handled in a very, very bad way. So, in a sense, perversely, however, these same people were avid consumers, in some cases, of work that we did for others. I think of the Department of Justice, and that's what reminded me of that. They were always on the telephone to me when I was running the Institute for Civil Justice, which is another thing we have to cover, asking for pre-release copies, asking for updates on what we were doing, what we were finding, and so on and so forth. Yet they would never put a penny, not one penny, into supporting the research. What they did was to take it, select from the work the decision, the parts of it they liked, use those parts, and ignore the rest. And I've come to expect that as being typical now of Congress and probably most domestic agencies. And I'm not sure we'll ever get back on, in spite of all the excitement of the campaign, that we'll ever get this ship righted again. I don't know. We may have just gone too far. Maybe I'm sounding too cynical. But
it's all right, a day after the convention's over.
That's right.
Perfectly allowed.
Well, I must admit that I had a sort of sour feeling when I awoke this morning and was greeted on CNN by the head of the Republican National Committee, who said, "The Democrats have had our turn, have their turn. It's our turn next," he said with an ominous air as I left the room. I was not looking forward to that.
So did this situation that sort of, I don't know how to describe it, but a tailing off of the heyday, did it cause you to lose key people and lose some of that sense of momentum and professional staff quality that you had built up previously?
I'm certain that it did in some ways. However, you know, one of the clearest illustrations I can give you of the political nature of things was the day that Howie Phillips took over the Office of Economic Opportunity. From then on, it became the haven of, Young Americans for Freedom, YAF, which is nothing but a right-wing ideological organization. It would have been the equivalent of the Democrats having put in some wildly left-wing, ultra-liberal, and entirely ideologically oriented group and having it run its programs. I don't think they did that. Even in the eyes of most Republicans, Phillips and his gang are fairly extreme, and those are the people we had to work with. There was no dialogue, there was no exchange of information, there was no, just berating one another. And you know, that gets kind of old after a while, and you wonder why you're doing it. There was, of course, with the Reagan administration, an increase in spending on national security affairs. We're a very bizarre country we live in. And the value of research was seen in those areas, I suppose probably because of the hardware component, where people can understand why you would have to put scientific endeavor into inventing a new space vehicle or a new airplane, or even a new 6x truck, and kind of the strategists, there's a need for a strategy, and there's a need for some social science and some economics that sort of gets dragged along in the wake of this sort of technology-driven research environment. But that didn't exist on the domestic side. It went away, and the budgets were cut. And we at RAND were, I think, very fortunate in that we, and we'll have to look at the numbers, somebody will have to look at the numbers and check this, we were able to handle the situation by, we had a reduction in force. The reduction in force came primarily on the national security side, not on the domestic side. And many of the domestic people who were so inclined moved over to the national security side and were so clearly inherently more capable than the people they replaced, that the institution as a whole probably gained in strength from the process. And this crossing over lines, I think, was a very important thing to do, and it was something that really restored my faith in our holding to the line all through the god-awful 60s and the terrible 70s of not hiring any professional at RAND who disavowed a willingness to work on national security affairs. So no matter how good somebody who came along was, if he said, "I ain't going to work on that stuff," we said, "Well, then you don't belong here." Because someday you may want to, someday you may have to, someday we may need you to. We may need your skills. This is one institution. It's got sort of two halves, but it is one institution, and it's dedicated to the national interest. And that's got at least two major components, domestic and national security. And to work here, to be a member of this institution, you have to be willing to participate in either one. Now, obviously, we understand when you come in, you're going to be in the health program or the education program or whatever. But that's no guarantee that that's where you're going to stay. And in return for that, you don't have to guarantee us that that's where you're going to stay, because your interests may take you elsewhere as well. That was very, very, very handy when we had to make, to accommodate to the great cuts of the Reagan administration. Incidentally, it was sort of a reprise with Weinberger, like the earlier one I had had in Sacramento. And the whole government was just shot through with that attitude. Infinitely different from the Nixon years. Somehow there was much more tolerance. There were many more, if I should use the word, intellectuals, program planners, people who wanted to get things done. Present in the Nixon administration than were in the Reagan years, so that we did just fine during the Nixon years. We had some difficulty, as I say, toward the end of that time when people like Howard Phillips came into power. But by and large, we found congenial people to talk with. Congeniality being defined in terms of understanding and receptivity, willingness to take a bet that we could help make things better, and I suppose some sort of underwriting desire to make things better, which I myself didn't find. And I did look very hard in the Reagan years.
Okay, let me go back and pick up a couple of loose ends. One of the things I was driving at earlier, my earlier question about the use of the Air Force as a model, was on the how you financially organize your relationships with New York, with HUD, and how foundation grants and stuff are also figured in into the financial picture. I mean, for example, when you worked with New York City, was it, you know, here's you know, we charge off for labor and overhead of certain categories, and on top of that, we ask for a 6% fee, and is that how you worked with HUD as well? I mean, did the essential financial model that the Air Force provided also carry over in the way you approach these other areas of activity?
Yes, the mechanical aspects of the financial arrangements were almost identical in virtually every case to those with the Air Force. One reason was that for some set of reasons that were unclear to me, precedent played an important role, and being the Air Force is a major part of the United States government. Given the fact that we had a government auditing agency which could say to places like HUD and HEW and New York City and Oshkosh or whatever, You don't have to worry about auditing this place. We have our rules. They're every bit as tight as yours, and we will see that they are enforced. There's a great advantage in being able to follow that model. Where we were much, much, much more mixed was on the degrees of intellectual freedom that we had. So that while the financial arrangements may have remained the same, you began to see things like bidding on contracts, even though we didn't bid on contracts where price was a deciding factor. When you get involved in the whole world of separate contracts and grants, you very quickly get into the world of defined research areas, in some cases research projects, and you begin to multiply both the intellectual difficulty for the staff and the management difficulty of holding together a behemoth like this, whereas you had an Air Force division with, let's pick a number, $20 million. You had a National Security division with, let's say, $20 million. And you had a domestic division with, let's say, $40 million. Each one of the first two had essentially one contract, and the domestic division came to have well over 100, probably as many as 150 contracts and grants at any given point in time. And trying to make a silk purse out of that inherent sow's ear was no mean feat. And it took a lot of rejecting of things that people wanted to do really motivated by the need to feel financially covered. And but there were things that were not that Rand really shouldn't be doing. And when you press these people, they would agree. They would say, you know, we gotta find something better. So there was perpetual review of every proposal before it went out of the House, and many, many, many of those proposals were simply rejected on the basis of inappropriateness, narrowness, tunnel vision, the researcher not having the skills to do the job, insufficient time, insufficient money. We just turned things down. And even during the very lean days, we continued to try to do that. Now, that has, by and large, I think, not become such a standard practice. And we've been in sort of hard domestic times for so long that I think that there have been really two kinds of trends. One is an increasing tendency to impose ideas from the top, which may or may not sell to the staff, and to proceed with research ideas and programs or projects without having intellectual leaders either on board or in mind to run the actual thing. And the other thing is a sort of a relaxation of our definition of what we should be doing and what we shouldn't be doing. And I don't think that has boded well for Rand. Now, I referred earlier to this, and I don't want to pass this because I think it's important, to the pressures that were brought about on the Air Force by Congress and by certain associations of for-profit companies or groups or consultants to control, to manage, to decrease, to shoot the Rand Corporation. And the Air Force came up with a whole series of schemes by which they intended to monitor the Rand program.
What time period are we talking
now
about?
Now we're talking about, again, in the, say, the mid-70s. And maybe a little earlier. sort of concurrent with the concurrent with Harry, concurrent with the growth of the domestic work. You know, the DOD took the posture that, I mean, I can remember Johnny Foster calling and saying, FCRCs are authorized to have 20% of their programs in non-military work. And we said to him, we're already at 35 and we're heading for 50. And he sort of just hung up the phone and let us alone. It was clear that he wasn't going to affect what we were going to do, and that we're not going to stand for that kind of thing. Now, I think, in my opinion, many of the devices that were arranged by senior levels of the Air Force were just that. They were devices whose sole purpose was to persuade outside interests that the Air Force was, quote, managing RAND, end quote. And I think that we at RAND overreacted to those devices and took them far, far too seriously, much more seriously than the Air Force ever did. And that resulted in taking single source funded divisions that were getting like $20-25 million, divisions which really could have maintained internal resource allocation mechanisms and met the conditions imposed by the Air Force. And somehow, either to be diverted into an imitation of the domestic division, which by the virtue of having a contract to do X instead of having a contract to save the world, was compartmentalized, to turn these divisions into a series of projects. I've forgotten how many. I think the Air Force division had, when I last looked, had something like 47, 48 projects divided into, I don't know, seven or nine programs or something, you know, and building up this big administrative reporting superstructure, all of them, all or most of which I think we could have gotten away without. And since I wasn't involved in that very much, except occasionally to say, why are we doing this? There is no need to do this. You're taking them much too seriously. Why don't you have the guts to behave like Ehrlichman when Nixon said to him, I want that RAND place closed in a week? To which Ehrlichman replied, yes, sir, and never did a thing. He was never seen again. We didn't have to do any of that. And I think it was a bad step in the wrong direction because it made the whole place look similar, much more similar than it had to, and much more structured and bureaucratic than it had to.
I'm a little unclear on the nature of what the Air Force was attempting to do and what strictures it was putting on the RAND activity.
Well, I think what the Air Force was intending to do and the strictures that it were placing on RAND were two different things. It was intending to have a framework which would demonstrate that it knew what was going on at RAND and that it could control what was going on at RAND through that knowledge and through a structure. And the structure was a series of programs and projects which they were briefed on periodically, on which they had the freedom to comment, and an innocent congressman might infer that they could thereby eradicate, change, cut the money away from, and so on and so forth. I don't believe the Air Force ever believed that they wanted to do that. But we behaved as if it were the intent of the Air Force to control us down to the last man. And therefore, we created this nightmare of a structure in the institution, which far exceeded anything I'm convinced that the Air Force wanted to see. Program managers, project deputy program managers, project leaders, then being a project leader grew to have status, so that generated more project leaders, and that created new programs, and you ended up with this proliferation of bureaucracy, which has really fragmented the work tremendously. Now, as I understand it, recently the Air Force came back to RAND and did something that I've been advocating for years that RAND ought to do, which is just cut out all this nonsense and reorganize itself along the line of three or four programs and deal with the projects as they come up, but cut out one and two man kind of activities and dignifying them with the title of RAND Project and Component 32 of RAND Program Y, and simply get on with our business in some kind of practical, pragmatic way. Well, the Air Force came around, as I understand it, and they said, we don't understand why you guys have all this structure. How can you have any flexibility if you have all this structure? You've got so many, you've got all these programs, you've got all these projects. Why don't you cut the number of programs to, I think it's 7, and cut the number of projects to, cut the projects from 41 or 47 or 44, whatever the number is, to 7. And channel your work in these main areas and be flexible within these main areas, which is exactly what I would have done, which I think is what the Air Force had in mind all along, with some variance, you know, when for the hot heat under the collar factor all the time. And we're now going back to that. George Donahue, who runs the Air Force Division, has just, not without a lot of internal dissension, because nothing gets done without a lot of internal dissension, has just moved the Air Force, you know, a lot of bureaucrats are losing their jobs. That creates dissension. And RAND has become far too full of bureaucrats, in my opinion. So George has his problems cut out for him, but these changes are being made. I think they could be made in the Army, although perhaps less easily, because the Army is not as experienced and sophisticated as this kind of thing as the Air Force is. The National Security Research Division is another problem. You've got too many cooks stirring that particular broth. You have every office of ARPA, for example, represented in, quote, formulating the program, end quote, and I suppose more important, what gives them leverage in supporting a certain portion of the program. So that Michael Rich has a continual battle to get things funded, to keep things alive, to start new things, because each one requires not only a sponsor, which the Air Force requires, which has turned out not to be a problem, but it requires a sponsor who's willing to back up his sponsorship with cold, hard cash. Right. And that's more serious. And when people get unhappy with management, I, in my present role as sort of a consultant and member of a department, I say, I want to describe to you a job, and then I want to ask you how you would like to have it. And you get up at 5 o'clock in the morning at home, and you get on the telephone, and you start talking with bureaucrats. And you talk until you're blue in the face and you're exhausted. You then hang up the phone, you get into your car, you come to RAND, you pick up the phone, and you spend the whole day talking with the same set of bureaucrats in Washington. And it's nothing but an argument and a hassle. There's never any substance. It's just all politicking around. That's the kind of job. How would you like to be the vice president in charge of this division? Because that's essentially what Michael Rich does.
Yeah.
It's come to that.
What do you identify this as sort of the precipitating event or events sometime in the mid-70s. What precisely was going on there? It's a little, I mean, RAND is, you know, in terms of where the Air Force spends money, is really small potatoes. And one shouldn't think that the Air Force would, or that RAND would represent much competition to contractors and other consulting groups in a sense. I mean, we're...
First of all, RAND is a line item in the Air Force budget.
Okay.
Secondly, RAND is an FF RDC, and there are a group of those. so that four small potatoes become, or seven small potatoes become a couple of very large potatoes, or what looks large, especially to people who are budget cutters and to people who think that the profitability of their enterprises is being adversely affected by these potatoes, namely the Beltway Bandits, for-profit consultants to government, individual consultants to government, who have banded together in various associations and have put the heat on Congress to knock this stuff off. There's no reason for an FFRDC. There's no reason for a RAND. And so what, you're quite right, in terms of, you know, sort of global terms, the resources devoted to RAND wouldn't fill a thimble. But they are disproportionately noisome and cause all kinds of quarrels. And I often thought that if people did something useful, instead of sitting around and arguing about the optimal size of the FFRDCs, the nation would be in infinitely better shape than it is today. But there's something inherently, the Armed Services Committee, the armed committees, will spend hours haggling over the RAND budget. Weeks, months, while all these major issues of national security and defense, they don't pay any attention to at all. And you begin to wonder what's going on here. How crazy are we getting in this country that those are how you set your priorities? You know, they're set by the doable, the specific and the doable. You can pick on RAND. It doesn't have a constituency. It's a line item, so it's prominent. It's a bone of contention because it produces controversial work, and it's in competition with people who don't want to have it in competition with it. So instead of considering programs X, Y, and Z, which might involve billions of dollars in space weaponry or space reconnaissance and so on, it's just so much easier to sit there and haggle over the RAND budget and the aerospace budget and so on and so forth, than to start really grappling with some of those issues.
And so you don't recall a precipitating instance, but just this kind of...
There was a precipitating instance. If there was a precipitating instance, it was a confluence, I think, of three things. One, Air Force dissatisfaction with RAND's performance. This was in the Rowan years. Secondly, increasing congressional concern, partly as reflected from their sources in the Air Force. You know, there's a lot of feedback.
Sure.
And thirdly, I think my chronology is right, it was about that time that these consultants united in virginity and purity, or whatever they are, began going up to the Hill and raising hell about these people. So all of these things came together, and then Dan did his thing, and it was a big mess, and it all came together and resulted in these difficulties.
Well, listening to you tell this story is really, and I'm a little ashamed to say so for somebody who's been looking at RAND for as long as I have, a little eye-opening. The image that you're presenting of the ability to do good work at RAND starting sometime in the 70s is very different from what one has of the image of doing work at RAND in the 1950s. In terms of just the intensity of outside pressures, the ability to make free and sort of intellectual choices about how you're going to proceed with your work, there seems to be a pretty far distance between the 1950s and the 1970s.
That's about my point.
Okay, I just wanted to be sure that I was.
RAND has changed, and it has changed a lot, and in some ways it's changed for the better. For example, I would say that the productivity measured in terms of intellectual output per person, however you measure that, has probably gone way up. We have much less room for exercising the INS syndrome, as I call it, the idleness and sloth syndrome. I mean, in the bad old days, there were people who walked in the door and never did anything except collect their paychecks, and nobody ever noticed. I don't think that was healthy. That doesn't happen much anymore. There are a few people jammed away in the woodwork that you have a hard time getting them out of there, but they know that somebody's watching them and they really ought to be doing something, even if they don't quite get around to doing it. In a sense, once you got into a mode of a contract by contract, grant by grant operation, you got that when you got the car. I mean, you're just in a box. You're in a dilemma. And nobody contracts anymore for great ideas, except possibly the Air Force. You don't find the Department of Education handing out contracts to redevelop the American education system. You'll find them handing out contracts to develop a new scheme. This is about as broad as they'll get, a new scheme for the financing of the university, public university systems. That's about as broad as they'll get these days. So, you know, you're right on the edge of becoming a job shop. And you have people who are increasingly concerned with survival instead of substance. And that's a stimulating environment, all right, but I'm not sure it's always stimulating in the right direction if you're really interested in generating new ways of thinking, brand new methods, and so on. Now, I don't want to make this sound bleaker than it is, because it's bleak enough. And that's why, as I say, I used to check with Ben for a sanity check to see whether we were really selling Rand down the stream, why I used to complain to my national security and to Don about what we were doing to ourselves on the national security side when I saw absolutely no reason for it. It's why I complained about the lack of RAND publications. If you look at data concerning the number of RAND publications, you will see that they began to fall off. They fell off largely on the national security side, if not entirely, because people on that side of the house, in my opinion, became less innovators, less scholars, and more consultants, in a not very nice sense of that word, who conceived their mission as dealing with a problem, finding an answer to the problem, briefing the answer, and never even writing it up if they can get out of it. Or if they're writing it, write it up, they can write it up in a form that goes only to the people who sponsored the work, and which is unreviewed. I don't like that situation. And, you know, but who am I now? And, well, I can complain to Thompson about it, and I do. It's Thompson himself who, when I was in the catbird seat, as one might say, and he was, as much as anybody does, sort of working for me, or a level or two below me, we used to meet and talk about, all the officers would meet and talk about various problems, and we talked about the publications problem, and which I had raised and caused, and Thompson, he said, oh, you want an answer to that? He said, I know what the answer to that is. I have met the enemy. It is us. We are the enemy. We are preventing our people from publishing by putting so much pressure on them to produce quick results, quick short-term results, that they're either not worthy of publication or the people don't have time enough to write them up. And he resolved very firmly to take steps to alleviate some of those pressures, but they haven't been alleviated. Not a great deal, anyway.
Okay, well, that's the very end of the tape here.